Today is Tuesday, March 20th. We're going to work more on respiratory physiology today. Okay, so on page 73, a couple of things just to lay the groundwork here. In order to breathe, we have to be mindful that there are two major muscles helping us breathe in. Those are the diaphragm, the dome-shaped muscle underneath the lungs, and the external intercostals, and they're located where?
In the ribs.
In the ribs, good. So in order to breathe, we then have a muscle that, you know, has to contract. The muscles only contract upon nerve stimulation. So what is the name of the nerve that travels through your neck that tells your external intercostals and diaphragm to contract?
Phrenic
nerve, good. So upon stimulation from the phrenic nerve, the diaphragm actually moves in a more flattened position. What happens to your intercostal muscles?
Expand.
Good. So we end up flaring out the rib cage and we end up flattening down that diaphragm muscle. Now, those muscle contractions lead to the first thing that must happen in order for us to inhale, and that is a change in our volume. What happens to the volume in your thoracic cavity?
It increases.
Good. Now, we know the opposite situation here. If you increase your thoracic cavity volume, what happens to the intrapulmonary pressure?
It decreases.
Good. Now, in order for you to inhale air, your intrapulmonary pressure must be what compared to the atmospheric pressure around your body?
Less than.
Good. So if we are 760 outside the body, we have to be less than 760 in order to inhale. So the air flows along a pressure gradient that allows for air to flow into our lungs during inhalation. Okay. So we actually breathe in for around 2 seconds at rest, and at that point, the respiratory center in the medulla stops telling the phrenic nerves to send nerve impulses. When you no longer tell the diaphragm and intercostal muscles to contract, they then relax. Into what position does that diaphragm return?
Dome-shaped.
It pokes back up toward the ribs. When the intercostal muscles relax, what position does your rib cage return to?
Normal.
Right, so your rib cage narrows, your diaphragm pushes up against your lungs. Now you've made a smaller space for your lungs. What just happened to the volume in your thoracic cavity?
Decrease.
And if volume decreases, the intrapulmonary pressure must
decrease.
Okay, so why do you exhale?
Pressure
is higher inside than outside, and you're right, you move out CO2. So we're following a pressure gradient. Air has to move along from the higher pressure inside to the lower pressure, which is now outside your body. Okay, so if you're thinking about keeping this stuff straight, what I would look at is, you know, first of all, figure out what the muscles are doing, if they're contracting or they're relaxing. Second, I would figure out what's happening to the volume in your thoracic cavity. And third, figure out what's happening to the pressure. Once you figure the pressure out, then you can say, okay, well, pressure is lower than the outside world, I breathe in. Or if pressure is higher than the outside world, what happens to that air?
Breathe out.
Right. So if you can figure out those three things without memorizing them, I think that will help you keep straight how inhalation and exhalation work. And I think talking it through to somebody or out loud, you know, by yourself even works to get that movement of air straight. Okay. Any part of this I can go back over for you, the whole story, pieces of it? Do you feel comfortable enough to go home and get this to stick? Okay. And if you need to hear it again on Thursday, let me know. We can go back and hit this again. Okay. Let's see. We need to move probably to page 74. Remind me, did we do the top half of the page? Okay. I thought we had. Okay, so it looks like we need to pick up about halfway down with abnormal breathing. we talked in class on Thursday of last week about eupnea. That EU prefix means true breathing, and that respiration rate is normally around 12 to 15 or even 12 to 18 breaths per minute. I may have mentioned to you last Thursday that I've heard the nursing classes use 12 to 18, so we'll look at anything inside that range as being a normal respiration rate. Keep in mind, this is at rest. This is an adult's respiration rate. Eupnea for a child is going to be faster than an adult's respiration rate. Okay, so we talked about that term last week. Let's talk about dyspnea. That term means shortness of breath or difficulty breathing. Okay, dyspnea, shortness of breath or difficulty breathing. We've probably all heard of apnea. What does that mean? Absence of breathing. Yeah, so we stop breathing. We know sleep apnea is certainly an issue for some people. And then the last one there is called hyperpnea. Hyperpnea means forceful breathing. And I know that you all have probably climbed the stairs in this building at some point. And if you start on the first floor and make your way to the fourth floor, you are doing hyperpnea by the time you probably reach third and fourth floor levels. So you can still maintain a normal respiration rate. You can still be, say, 12 to 15 breaths per minute, but you're the heavy breather now. So, right? Okay, so that's hyperpnea, that's forceful breathing. Your rate may not change, but the force of the respiration changes. Let me repeat something that may have gotten lost toward the end of class on Tuesday, or Thursday rather, of last week. To inhale requires work. It requires ATP to make your muscles contract. Now, does expiration require any work?
No.
So when you're normally expiring or exhaling out air, there is no work required on your muscles. All it requires is for them to do what?
Relax.
Right. So the difference here is hyperpnea may actually involve some of those expiratory breathing muscles. You have like the sternocleidomastoid in the neck. You've got trapezius in the back. Even your lats can help you breathe. So if you're doing what we call hyperpnea or forceful breathing, you may actually involve some of those extra muscles to help you force the air out. So when we talked about emphysema, and we talked about the muscle wasting around the chest cavity, that comes from actively forcing air out, not something people with a healthy respiratory system have to do. Okay, so that takes us down to two terms, hyperventilation and hypoventilation. So I want to talk about these terms and just ignore the bullet points underneath them for just a moment. Hyper and hypoventilation actually change your rate of respiration. If you're breathing faster than, say, 15 to 18 breaths per minute, how would you classify that kind of fast breathing rate? If you're breathing really fast. Hyper, good. Hyperventilation is breathing faster than, say, 15 or 18 breaths per minute. What if you're breathing only 5 breaths per minute?
Hypo.
Hypo, good. So keep in mind, we're not talking about forceful breathing. All we're talking about right now is a rate change. So you're either going faster than 18 breaths per minute, or you're going slower than 12 breaths per minute. Why those numbers? Why 12 and 18? That's eupnea. Yeah, that's normal eupnea. So anything outside that range, we can now put into one of these other categories. Hyper for faster, hypo for slower. Okay. You so far so good?
Yeah.
And we're going to take a big step into chemistry right now, so I want to make sure you're okay with me. All right. So on your worksheet near the bottom of your page is this equation, and it is called a bicarbonate buffer system. Okay, so what I need to tell you up front is this. The number one stimulus for you to breathe is actually not oxygen. That may come as a surprise. The number one stimulus for you to breathe is actually carbon dioxide. And the reason it's your number one stimulus for breathing is because it is a big influencer on your blood pH. So that's why we look at this particular equation called the bicarbonate buffer system. Carbon dioxide, under normal resting conditions, is the number one stimulus for your breathing. Okay, so it can actually change your respiration rate before oxygen will. All right, so you probably recognize carbon dioxide in this equation. Carbon dioxide levels are controlled by your respiration rate. I can breathe faster and I can get rid of more CO2. What if I breathe slower? What happens to my CO2 levels?
Increases.
Okay, so let's do that again. If I breathe faster, pant like a dog, right? Okay, breathe faster, I'm blowing out more and more of my CO2, so I'm losing my CO2. If I have deep, slow breathing, I keep more CO2, okay? So how I breathe is gonna influence how much CO2 is in my bloodstream. So normally when CO2 is in your bloodstream, it interacts with the water in your blood plasma and it can interact with the water that's in your red blood cells. When CO2 and that water in your bloodstream interact together, they create this product here called carbonic acid. We're not going to worry a lot about carbonic acid because like acids do in water, it breaks up. Okay? So when you break up an acid, you give off hydrogen ions, and those hydrogen ions can influence the blood pH. And of course, the remaining product here is this. This is called the bicarbonate ion. Okay, let's do this again. The number one influence for your respiration rate is carbon dioxide. Okay, if I breathe faster, I'm panting off excess CO2. Okay, so I'm losing CO2 from my bloodstream. If I deep breathe and breathe really slowly, I'm not getting as rid of much CO2, so I'm keeping more of it, so I'm retaining more CO2 in my bloodstream. We're gonna take that somewhere in just a moment. We know that any CO2 transported in your bloodstream is typically going to combine with the water in your bloodstream. That creates a middle product called carbonic acid. And like acids do, when you place them in water, they break up and they make hydrogen ions and they make this other item here. This one's called bicarbonate ion. So we're going to focus on those hydrogen ions for just a moment because they can have a big influence over your blood pH. I'm not going to talk so much right now about bicarbonate. We are going to touch on it. It is a major ion controlled by your urinary system. So, you know, we'll come back and discuss that certainly later on. What I want to tell you about this equation is this. You'll notice arrows going the both ways. They go left and they go right. This whole equation here is like a seesaw. I can tip it to the right and make more hydrogens and more bicarbonates. Or like a seesaw, I can tip it to the left and make less hydrogens and more carbon dioxide. I can swing it back and forth the way we need to go. So what is that blood pH supposed to be?
7.3.
Good, so that's a number emblazoned in your brain, right? Got stuck in there. Okay, so I'm just gonna make a note, that is normal blood pH. I want to take the class that's next door that listens to music and hears videos every class.
It must be music appreciation.
It's like every time we're in here, I hear that. Sounds interesting.
Today it would put me to sleep, though. It's too raining outside.
That's true. Because it's just lull. Okay. So let's go back and hit that CO2 for just a moment. CO2 levels in your bloodstream are directly related to the amount of hydrogens that you have in your bloodstream. So the more CO2 you have, the more hydrogens you can make. Okay, so let me repeat that. CO2 is directly related to the amount of hydrogen ions you have in your bloodstream. The more CO2 you have in your bloodstream, the more hydrogen ions you have in your bloodstream. Okay, so let's take this back a piece to Bio-210. The more hydrogens you have in your bloodstream, the more acidic your blood becomes. So are we heading lower on the pH scale or higher?
Lower.
Lower.
We're heading lower, good. So I'm just gonna make a note down here that if you're below 7.35 and you're looking at the respiratory system, you're probably looking at excess carbon dioxide that can lead to excess hydrogen ions, and that causes a drop in pH, okay? And what is the name of that condition when you're below 7.35?
Acidosis.
Good. Let me put a caution out here, because what sometimes people do is they try to memorize this. I mean, I know you got to start somewhere with getting it to stick, but just be really aware of these arrows here. Increases in CO2 and hydrogens actually don't cause an increase in pH. The pH heads in the opposite direction. pH goes down when you've got too much CO2. So, you know, if you've got a little kid, and I know some of you probably don't have kids yet, but if you can remember back when you were a little kid, when you get really mad at your parents, you probably say, I'm going to hold my breath. Watch me, or I will hold my breath, and I'm going to die. Your parents probably laughed at you too, and go do your business, because you're not going to hold your breath and die, because CO2 levels increase the longer you hold your breath. Your bloodstream holds more hydrogen ions, which makes your blood pH more acidic. And guess what your brain says?
Breathe.
So, you know, that's what excess CO2 is going to say to your brain. It's going to say, hey, brain, we're building up too much acid here. Brain says, you should breathe. Okay, so that's kind of where we're heading with this stuff. Acidosis is going to make your brain kick on that respiratory center and tell you to breathe. You've probably heard about those deep sea divers. They take a rope and they go down hundreds of meters, mm-hmm. and then on their ascent back up, they're almost to the top, and then you hear about them dying. Mm-hmm. And the reason is, most likely, they're getting so acidic that their brain says, breathe. And it says it so strongly that they can't control it anymore, and so their diaphragm kicks on, and they unfortunately pull in water, not air. So acidosis is a really strong stimulus for making you breathe. So when you do start breathing, what do you exhale out?
CO2.
Yeah, get that CO2 out of your bloodstream. And as you exhale more of it out, it takes with it those hydrogens. So those two are linked together there. Let's see. Let's talk about the other end of the spectrum. If we have, say, deep breathing exercises, that would take us here, okay? But if you're excited, nervous, and you're hyperventilating, that will take you up here. So if you're breathing really, really quickly, you're excited, you're nervous, you're going into a test, you've got yourself really worked up, what happens to all that CO2 when you're panting and breathing really quickly? You breathe it out, right? And if you get rid of your CO2, you're also getting rid of what?
Hydrogen.
Hydrogen ions. And the less hydrogens you have,
the higher your pH.
The higher your pH, good. And we call that situation
alkalosis.
Good, alkalosis. So I'll tell you a quick story. One time I was cooking dinner and I was, you know, kind of in a hurry, and I had some frozen chicken breast that I wanted to thaw really quickly. And if you've ever worked with frozen chicken, there's nothing quick about thawing it.
Nice.
So I had it running under hot water and they were frozen together and I really wanted them to separate. So I got out my knife and I thought if I wedge them apart, they'll thaw quicker.
Yeah,
the knife slipped, cut through my finger, and just pumped blood like crazy. You know, I didn't know if I cut something important in there or not. I could see stuff that I didn't think I should see.
Oh my goodness.
So I wrapped it in a roll of paper towel, drove to an urgent care, and you know, by the time I got there, I'd already imagined that I had cut through tendons and I probably needed surgery. Oh, this is crazy, right? So, you know, when I walk in the door, they soak me in iodine, they put Steri-Strips on me and they send me home. I thankfully had not cut through anything in there that was important. But I'd worked myself up really good by the time I walked in the urgent care. So that's what I was doing. I was hyperventilating and I was blowing off my CO2. I was making myself go into respiratory alkalosis. So anytime you change your respiration rate and you get yourself into one of these categories, you're causing either respiratory alkalosis or respiratory acidosis. So if your respiration rate changes, the cause of your pH change, we call it a respiratory situation. So what I'm kind of leading you into is acid-base balance. I know you guys will work on this in lab very soon. Okay, so let me take you to the bottom of that page. We're still on page 74. And that bullet point hyperventilation there has some blanks to fill in. And you know, when I was driving to get my finger looked at, I was hyperventilating of my own cause, right? And so if you hyperventilate, you blow off all your CO2, leaving you with a state of hypocapnia, meaning too little carbon dioxide. Hypocapnia means too little carbon dioxide. And respiratory alkalosis means there's too few or too little what?
Hydrogen.
Good. Too few hydrogen ions. And by hyperventilating, you can also lead yourself into hyperoxia, meaning too many oxygens. Good. Okay, and on the flip side, like we were talking earlier, if you take a little kid that's mad at his parents and you say, you know, okay, he's gonna hold his breath, punish his parents, he'll eventually pass out because of that acidosis condition.
My son used to do that. He would get so angry. He started at 2.
Oh, wow.
Scream and hold his breath and he would pass out. Me and Ridley just turned blue and pass out.
Wow, did it scare you at first?
It did, and I was so excited he was breathing, I couldn't tear up his behind when he come to, but he did that a lot. Thankfully, he grew out of it. But
I was going to say, about probably eventually got over that.
He did.
Wow, that would be scary.
It was very scary.
Yeah.
Very scary.
So if you hyperventilate and you're holding your breath, you're building up what in your bloodstream? Good. And the name, fanciness for that, is hypercapnia. There's a bunch of other terms out there. If you Google excess CO2 and put in hypercapnia, there's like two or three other terms that will pop up. So this one, you be aware that there's more than one term that means excess CO2. Let's see, you can also build up excess hydrogens. That leads us into a case of respiratory acidosis. So if your respiratory system is at fault for making you retain CO2, then that acidic condition is a respiratory-induced condition. Let's think back. We talked about a respiratory disorder where people retain CO2, their alveoli had become ruptured. Do you remember the name of that condition? Get it from smoking? Emphysema. Yeah. So people with emphysema have a consistently chronic case of respiratory acidosis. So that means that they're getting too much CO2, or they're retaining too much, and they're not able to blow off the CO2 and by nature blow off those hydrogens. We also see hypoxia when we have too little oxygen in the system. That can come from hyperventilation as well. How do you feel so far about this material? Feel okay? Okay, let me emphasize what we are talking about right now is cause and effect. You know, I mentioned to you that I purposely was breathing faster. I was excited and nervous about cutting my finger in half. I was controlling my respiration rate, and those chemical changes in my bloodstream were a result of me breathing faster. And Sabrina, you're talking about your little boy purposely holding his breath, right? So if you breathe slower, you're gonna see an increase in CO2 and a decrease in that blood pH. So if your respiration rate changes, we see these chemical changes result in the bloodstream. What I'm getting ready to take you to is not necessarily cause and effect, but it's this negative feedback stuff. If you have blood chemistry issues, your respiration rate may change to cause your blood chemistry to get back into normal. So what we have to understand is bottom of page 74 is how respiration affects blood chemistry. Okay. okay? Bottom of 74 is how respiration affects your blood chemistry. Now we're going to use that on page 75 to actually fix blood chemistry problems. Good so far? I haven't scared you off yet, right? Okay. Okay, so let's see. What I'm going to do is use examples to talk about page 75. I'm going to give you a picture here to look at. So I should repeat that there is a respiratory center in your medulla oblongata. There is a piece of your pons, of course, that is involved in the respiration as well. And you have chemoreceptors that are found in the central nervous system in your brain that are picking up on chemical changes. Specifically, here you go, carbon dioxide and hydrogen. So like I mentioned, the number one stimulus for breathing is what?
Carbon dioxide.
Yeah, look at that. There is not even an oxygen detector in your brain, not in that particular part at least. The peripheral receptors that are looking at oxygen levels are in two old locations. We've learned about these before. Where are your chemoreceptors located? Good. Aortic arch and common carotid arteries. So you actually have receptors, for oxygen there, CO2 and hydrogen there as well. So interesting to note that our number one stimulus for breathing is CO2, which is related to hydrogens in our bloodstream. And that's primarily what we're looking for to change our respiration rate. Okay, so if you want to change your respiration rate, how does your medulla communicate with your diaphragm? You tell it, right? Phrenic nerve, good. So phrenic nerve comes through your neck. It tells your intercostal muscles and your diaphragm to either speed up and contract faster or slow down and contract slower. Let me make a point here. We've talked a lot about sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system stimulation, right? That is not part of the conversation. So in order for you to change your respiration rate, the communication comes from your medulla and pons, through your phrenic nerves, and to your diaphragm and intercostals. This has nothing to do with sympathetic and parasympathetic. Okay? So nothing to do with sympathetic and parasympathetic. As a side note, we learned last week that if you're under sympathetic control, your breathing passageways will do what? Dilate. Yeah, and if you're under parasympathetic control, your passageways constrict. Right. So parasympathetic and sympathetic don't directly change your breathing rate. They just cause either dilation or constriction of those respiratory passages.
The accessories,
yeah. Okay. So let me give you an example. I'm going to start with something like vomiting. Vomiting has really nothing to do with breathing, right? Okay, so if you're vomiting, it's your digestive system that's removing stomach contents. And when you vomit, you're removing hydrochloric acid from your stomach. Ah, that is something to hang on to. Hydrochloric acid. Acid releases what? Yeah, so if you're removing hydrochloric acid from your stomach, you're ultimately keeping it from getting in your bloodstream. So vomiting actually puts you into what we call alkalosis. To be specific, it's called metabolic alkalosis when you vomit. So if you're vomiting and you're experiencing alkalosis, you feed this information back to your brain. So your brain says, oh, you don't have enough what or what? Carbon dioxide, and you don't have enough hydrogen. Okay, so let's talk about how we're going to fix that. If you don't have enough carbon dioxide and you don't have enough hydrogens, you come to your brain and your brain says, you need to keep more hydrogens because we're dealing with a situation of alkalosis. Okay, I'm going to put that as a little note there. That's alkalosis. So what should the brain tell the diaphragm to do so that we keep more hydrogens?
Slow
down your breathing, right. So the message is coming through your phrenic nerves in the neck, slow down. So we stimulate the diaphragm less frequently, and we start retaining more carbon dioxide and more hydrogens. Okay, so is this process hyperventilation or hypoventilation?
Hypoventilation.
Good. So let's think about how this is going to fix our problem. If somebody's had a severe case of vomiting, they've put themselves into alkalosis by losing so many hydrogens from their stomach, how does breathing slower actually help return their blood pH to normal?
Helps retain the carbon dioxide.
Good. And carbon dioxide by itself is half the fix, right? If you retain more CO2, what do you end up actually retaining?
Hydrogens.
That's it. Good. So keep the CO2, turn them into hydrogens in your bloodstream, and now your blood pH starts to come back down. So interesting that, you know, a severe case of vomiting can actually make you hypoventilate as a response. Okay. Let's take another scenario. Let's say that we have a diabetic patient, and this person is constantly having high blood sugar issues. We haven't really talked about ketoacidosis, but that is a side effect of having high blood sugar. There's my key word, ketoacidosis. What does that tell me about the blood pH?
It's acidic.
It's acidic. It's too low. And that person has too many what in their bloodstream? Good. Too many hydrogens, which can be treated as too many CO2s. So if we have too many CO2s, or if we have too many hydrogens, we're going to treat this the same way. So the feedback loop comes from those chemoreceptors in your aortic arch, your common carotid arteries, and even those chemoreceptors in your brain. They tell your medulla oblongata that we're looking at an acid situation in the bloodstream. The body, or you know, the brain is going to need to tell the body how to get rid of this excess CO2. So what is the feedback loop? What do we do? Yes, send a message by the phrenic nerve, tell the diaphragm to breathe faster. Why does that help our situation when you're in acidosis? Get rid of the carbon dioxide, right? Okay, so if you go to your next door neighbor and he's a diabetic and he's breathing really fast, you say, ah, he's actually trying to get rid of that excess CO2, which in turn blows off those excess hydrogens. So you actually can look at somebody who's a diabetic and, you know, kind of figure out, you know, are they looking at an acid situation? Are they looking at acidosis? Okay, so hyperventilate. Have I lost you anywhere? Are you feeling okay so far?
Let's just write a little bit.
Breathe faster.
What did you say the condition was?
It's called ketoacidosis.
K-E-T-O.
Thank you. Sure. All right, so I got another one for you. Sometimes people take antacids for a stomach ache, and because it's over the counter, you know, you can take a whole bottle of Tums if you're feeling like it, right? Well, we really shouldn't take a whole bottle of Tums because there's a problem that can arise from it. Numerous problems can arise from that. One of the issues with taking Tums is they are antacids, and what do they lower?
Your acidity.
Your acidity, right. So they make your stomach more alkaline. And by nature, this actually means that you're not going to have as much acid absorbed into your bloodstream later on in the digestive system. So if you're looking at a case of taking excess Tums for a really bad stomach ache, then this is what we've got. We've got too few hydrogen ions in the bloodstream. And what is the feedback loop that results? What should we do about breathing?
Breathe slower.
Slow down the breathing, right. And so how does a person who has taken Tums by breathing slower, how does that fix their problem?
They're able to retain the carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
Good.
You end up. I knew somebody that did that though, and they didn't do that. They were just always hyped up. So their respiration rate was high, and they were taking Tums.
If they got,
they chewed it like candy.
If they've got calcium in there, which a lot of those things do, that may be the reason that they're hyped up instead of breathing slower. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of that's an evil combination of stuff to take.
I mean, you know, it's like it was on speed.
Right. I bet you it was. I bet you it was the calcium in there. Yeah. All right, let's do another one. Chemoreceptors not only pick up on CO2 and hydrogen, they also pick up on oxygen levels in the bloodstream. So let's now talk about an oxygen issue. For somebody who's gone into the mountains and is not used to the lower levels of oxygen, they may experience mild hypoxia, and that means they're having low oxygen levels. So I'm going to put that over here with this picture, decreased oxygen. We know that the chemoreceptors detect the low oxygen levels, and they have to be pretty darn low in order to stimulate a chemoreceptor, because the number one stimulus for breathing is actually what?
CO2,
right. So it must be a really bad case of hypoxia, really low levels. That feeds information into your medulla oblongata. And how do you get more oxygen into your bloodstream? Good. Phrenic nerve tells the diaphragm to increase the breathing rate, so your respiration rate will increase. Good. That's called hyperventilation. So even low oxygen levels can act as a stimulus if they're into what we consider hypoxic territory. So let me make a point here. For the person who's gone to the mountains and is experiencing hypoxia, the solution was to have this person breathe faster. How does that help this person?
Increase oxygen levels.
Okay. Catch the detail here. If they're in the mountains and they have low levels of oxygen, right, that's their only problem. So when they breathe faster, that's the only problem I'm going to fix. So by breathing faster, I'm just going to say I'm breathing in more oxygen. That's going to help me restore that oxygen back. Notice there was no pH issue here. There was no mention of CO2 levels or hydrogen ion levels. So, you know, you want to fix only the problem that we're dealing with. You know, they may in fact have CO2 that's starting to get out of balance there, but the main issue that was stimulating the breathing rate was the oxygen. Okay, so likewise, if you've got a person who's had ketoacidosis, you know, they may not have an oxygen issue. They may simply have a pH issue. So we're kind of looking at these things kind of separately. Let's talk about another issue. Sometimes when people go into the hospital, they place an oxygen cannula in the nose, and they are left with that cannula in, and they don't really think a whole lot about it. And sometimes people may wear one of those oxygen meters on their fingers. Okay, so if you're given, say, a supply of oxygen into your nose, you may in fact be getting excess oxygen. We call that hyperoxia. The excess condition actually can be bad for us. It can be toxic to our cells. So in the case of having too much oxygen being administered to you, this feedback loop is picked up on by chemoreceptors, and we take it to the control center. Where's the control center? Good. What decision is made by your medulla? Breathe slower. So we carry it out by what nerves? Good. And your diaphragm responds by? Slowing down the breathing. Right. So in fact, if you place an oxygen cannula in someone's nose, and it's giving them excess oxygen, they may in fact breathe slower in response to reduce the amount of oxygen they're getting in the bloodstream. So again, I didn't mention any issue here with CO2 or hydrogen. They may have a normal pH. It's just that oxygen problem that we're trying to fix. How do you feel so far about this topic? Y'all sound like you're with me on the same page, which is good. Let me cut you loose for a few minutes on page 76. If you want to work with a buddy, feel free. I'll try to circulate around if you need help, and then we'll do answers in just a minute. Okay, so the first problem there talks about kidney failure, which can lead to a buildup of hydrogen ions in the bloodstream. And you've got metabolic alkalosis as the problem, sorry, acidosis as the problem there. Excuse me, that's what we want to look at. When you're talking about acidosis, are you talking about too many or too few hydrogen ions?
Too many.
Too many, good. So that's our stimulus for this problem, is having too many of those hydrogens. So let me mention this. There's two controlling systems for blood pH. One is respiratory system, the other is your urinary system. If your urinary system is broken, like in the case here for, say, kidney failure, then you can't say, hey, kidneys, do your job, because they can't. The other system then has to pick up the slack, and that's why the respiratory system is going to work on maintaining that blood pH problem. So that's kind of why we're looking at breathing rates for a kidney issue. So what happens to the respiratory center to restore normal pH? Good. Increased phrenic nerve stimulation. In other words, you could put down hyperventilate. Okay. And how does that fix the problem?
Increases.
So if you breathe faster, what are you getting rid of more?
CO2.
And that, of course, takes with it those hydrogens. Okay. So you blow off more CO2 during exhalation. That gets rid of the hydrogens in the bloodstream. That was number one.
So we just increase breathing?
So is breathing increased?
Breathing is increased. You could also write down hyperventilation. And part C there, how does the respiration rate change, restore blood pH to normal? Get rid of that excess CO2, which takes with it the hydrogens, and that's going to put the pH back to normal. How did you do with that first one? Do good? Okay. Let's try number two. If we've got antacid overdose and too few hydrogens, those hydrogens are going to lead to a respiration rate change. That is your stimulus. Too few hydrogens. There's another way you could write it. What other word means the same thing?
Alkalosis.
Good. What does the respiratory center decide to do about alkalosis? Good. Decreased stimulation. You could say we now hypoventilate.
When you're talking about decreased stimulation, that's concerning the diaphragm, right?
Yeah. Stimulate it less. That's right. And the slower you breathe, the more you're going to keep CO2, and that's hydrogens. Good. Okay, so stimulus is alkalosis. The respiratory center decreases stimulation. We then hypoventilate. And the respiration rate change basically makes you keep more carbon dioxide and more hydrogens. Do okay with number two? Mm-hmm. Or, go ahead.
Okay, well, in the exam, because for the part C on that one, I only talked about hydrogen, and I didn't talk about the carbon. Would that like count off or anything if I did mention one?
I would probably, if I'm looking to blow off something through exhalation, I can't actually blow out hydrogens. I can only blow out CO2, so that's a key part of it.
Okay.
So yeah, I would put both on. Exhale faster to get rid of that CO2, which then in turn removes hydrogens from the blood. Okay, that's a good, very good question. Number three, we do have a hypoxia issue here. That is our stimulus, hypoxia. What does hypoxia mean?
Low oxygen,
good. And the respiratory center responds by? Increased respiration. And how does that fix your problem?
Takes in more oxygen.
Takes in more oxygen. Good. just an opportunity again to repeat, she didn't have a problem with pH. She didn't have a problem with CO2, nor with hydrogen ions. So the faster respiration rate is only to fix that oxygen issue. So you really don't have to discuss the other, you know, gases there. All right, number four, if you notice someone breathing quickly, they're actually trying to restore blood pH. What problem are they trying to compensate for?
Acidosis.
Acidosis, right. Good. Number five, aspirin overdose causes overstimulation of the respiratory center. Basically, what aspirin can tell your respiratory center to do is breathe, 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 breathe. You know, it's a rapid, you know, stimulation over and over. So if you're breathing really quickly there, part A, what pH imbalance results?
Acidosis.
Breathe really fast.
Acidosis.
I'm hearing both.
Acidosis.
Alkalosis.
Faster I breathe, let's go down here. The faster I breathe, the more I'm gonna blow off my CO2.
Right.
And cause alkalosis.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Can you explain that again, please?
Sure. The faster I breathe, the more I'm going to blow off those CO2s. And the more CO2 I lose, the more hydrogen we lose. Okay, so the faster we breathe, the more CO2 we lose, and the more hydrogens we lose. That puts us into alkalosis. Okay, and of course, that kind of explains part B there. Yeah, that kind of hits the why, doesn't it?
And what was the why?
The why is, you know, if you're breathing faster due to overstimulation, uh-huh, you're going to be losing carbon dioxide more quickly, and that leads to the loss of more hydrogens. Okay, so the why is the faster you breathe, the more CO2 you lose, the more hydrogens you lose. Aspirin's a weird one. It actually can take you through respiratory issues and metabolic issues, acidosis and alkalosis, so it's a very bizarre overdose. Let's see, number six, a pulmonary embolism can cause hypoxia or hypoxemia, kind of a related issue. What does the respiratory center do when you have low oxygen levels?
Increases
the respiration rate, tells you to breathe faster. You're right, hyperventilate is a good way to respond. Okay, so the respiratory center responds by increasing the respiration rate to hyperventilate. And part B, how does the respiration rate change restore oxygen levels to normal?
Taking
more oxygen, good. How you doing so far? Okay. Number seven, cigarette smoke contains carbon monoxide. Let me caution you, that does not say carbon dioxide. Carbon monoxide is a little different. And it actually bumps oxygen off of the binding sites from hemoglobin, so it causes low oxygen levels. That, in fact, is your stimulus, low oxygen. And the respiratory center responds by increasing respiration or hyperventilating. So the respiratory center responds by increasing respiration or hyperventilating. Therefore, if you're looking at hypoxia from cigarette smoke, what impact does that have on the brain?
Less
oxygen to the brain, oxygen deprivation. So for anyone who smokes, don't do it before a test, right? All right, to wrap up number eight, let's see, we've got an oxygen cannula in the nose. They may experience decreased respiration. Why?
It's
Excess oxygen, good. They may be getting excess oxygen. For number eight, they may be getting excess oxygen. For number nine, we've talked about ketoacidosis related to diabetics with high blood sugar. And if a person is experiencing acidosis, you may notice a rate change in respiration. How?
Increase.
Hyperventilate. Good. They may be hyperventilating, or that respiration rate may be increased. Okay, so for number nine there, respiration rate may increase. Alternately, you could say hyperventilate. And number 10, if your respiratory center can't handle a pH problem, what other system also does the same pH balance issues?
Urinary system,
good. Just got a few minutes left. I'd like to orient you a little bit on page 77. That's probably all we'll do in the last few minutes that we've got. Here a little bit. I want to talk to you about something called Dalton's Law on the very top of our next page. That looks like page 77. This particular law is based on the gases in the air that you breathe. You'll notice that this is the air that we're breathing here. There's oxygen, nitrogen, very small amount of argon gas, water vapor, carbon dioxide, and that roughly makes up our air. You may find it interesting to note that not oxygen, but nitrogen is the majority of the air that you breathe. It's about 78% of your air. Oxygen only makes up around 21% of the air that you breathe. So Dalton's law is based on this fact. Each of these gases is part of a mixture, and each one carries their own partial pressure. So which one of these gases do you think carries the most partial pressure?
Nitrogen.
Yeah, nitrogen, because it's got the most percentage. Gases like argon and water vapor and even CO2, they should have a very low partial pressure. But the ones we're really interested in are oxygen and CO2. I should also mention to you that when they talk about partial pressure of each gas, they use a P in front of the gas name. And like Sesame Street, it could be big P, it could be little P. Either one indicates to us that we're talking about the partial pressure. In other words, that partial pressure is the pressure or force exerted by each gas as part of a mixture. Okay, so it's the pressure exerted by that gas as part of a mixture. So we know that these gases move into our bodies and out of our bloodstream by simple diffusion. No energy is required. These gases move simply along a diffusion or a pressure gradient. So that's kind of what we want to appreciate here is, you know, really there's no ATP involved except for breathing in to get those gases to move to their destination. So let's talk about this chart, which is next. If you happen to have a color printout of this, you'll notice that there are some numbers here in red. Those are the only numbers you really have to know off of this document. So let's kind of ignore nitrogen gas for right now. That gas is only important for those who go deep sea diving. Let's focus on oxygen. You'll notice that oxygen follows a pressure gradient from outside your body where you have a high pressure. Into your body, the pressure drops. Water vapor mixes with the air that you breathe and reduces the partial pressure of oxygen. And then this is where it matters. If you take a sample from an artery, we call it an arterial blood gas sample, or an ABG for short. In that sample, we expect to see a partial pressure of oxygen between 80 and 100 millimeters mercury. only if you drop below 60 do you run into problems. At 60 millimeters mercury pressure, what problem do we have with oxygen? And at that hypoxic level, what happens to your respiration rate? It increases. So you'll notice something about these numbers. There is a steady decline here. They drop from 159 outside our bodies to around 40 in our cells. So what are our cells doing with that oxygen? Cellular respiration. Yep, making ATP. Good. A waste product of making ATP is a gas known as carbon dioxide. So you'll notice the highest source of it is in our cells. It diffuses into our capillaries, where the normal levels are 35 to 45 millimeters of mercury. That again is a number I would highlight and know. And also, the out of range numbers are important. You'll get to this in acid-base balance in lab about a week or two. If you're less than 35 millimeters mercury, that means you don't have enough CO2 in your bloodstream. If you don't have enough CO2, you also don't have enough what?
Hydrogens.
So that leads you to a case of alkalosis. Okay, so that's less than 35 millimeters mercury. If you have greater than 45 millimeters mercury of CO2, you've got too much, and that leads to excess hydrogens and white blood pH problem.
Acidosis.
Good. So again, move it along a pressure gradient, exhale it out of the body, we flow from high pressure to low pressure for both these gases. So why don't we say the bold term there, external respiration, we'll save that for Thursday. I will wrap this chapter on Thursday. You may want to read ahead about oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curves.